And during the few moments that we have left, we want to have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me. Us. We want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Until then, ain't the devil happy? Destroy our own bodies. Too many niggas chilling, bad boys boom boom. This leaves no room for the flowers to bloom. Seeds blow in the wind, another drug killing. What are we accomplishing? Nothing. What's the matter? Why every time I look around, another brain gets splattered? Some pockets get fatter, but it don't matter. The devil's the only one who really gets fatter. Lead ruptures flesh, spleens are shattered, dreams are shattered. Another queen without a king. What will our children become without proper guidance? Probably nothing. So ain't the devil happy? Ain't the devil happy? Niggas are in a state of nothingness. Hopelessness, lifelessness. If you're in range, I hope you hear this and try to change this, cause it's disastrous. Who gets the most loot? Who gets bust? Dollar bill, y'all, is the God we trust. The days blow by like dust. Even men of steel rust. We're out here acting ridiculous when only we can save us. Mentally enslave us for little or nothing. Kill our neighbors. Animalistic, cannibalistic behavior. Look to the sky for your savior. He won't save ya. He didn't save your forefathers. Why bothers, brothers? You must discover the power of self. Know thyself or find thyself. Hating thyself, killing thyself. While he collects the wealth that you sit back and murder for, ain't the devil happy?
That's a policy while talking freedom. Right. All of the major wars in this country down to the Civil War, I fought to extend slavery. Yeah. The most expensive war before the Civil War was the war with the Seminoles, Florida. Alabama, swamps. Why? Slaves were running away, hiding among the native population. Creeks, Choctaws, Chickasaws, Cherokees, Seminoles. The native populations were fighting to maintain their freedom and their independence to keep those slaves with them as free people. This country spent $40 million fighting to exterminate Native Americans. The eastern part of the United States. When they couldn't exterminate, they shipped the Cherokee, the five civilized tribes they call them, on the Trail of Tears in 1842 out to the west, Oklahoma, reservations. They confined the Seminoles, who are still at war technically with the United States, into the Everglades in Florida. It's the most expensive war this country fought before the Civil War. Not about freedom, but to extend slavery. Right. It's the next war before the Civil War, Mexican War. Remember the Alamo? Let's not remember the Alamo. They have yet to make a movie about the Alamo. They made another one trying to clean it up a little bit. Where's the movie that says that Jim Bridges, a slaveholder? David Crockett's a slaveholder. Sam Houston is a slaveholder. Stephen A. Austin is a slaveholder. They are fighting to expand slavery into Mexico because Mexico had abolished slavery. Santa Ana may have been a dictator, but there was no slavery in Mexico, and slaves were running away from the South into Mexico to be free. Freedom-loving Texans carrying their slaves into Mexico said, you cannot bring these people here. We don't have slavery. What's the response to declare Texas independent? Not for freedom, but to expand slavery. Make that movie. Put Denzel in that one. You know, as a slave who had run away and is fighting in the Mexican army at the Alamo. That's the movie. Black people in the Mexican army at the Alamo fighting slaveholders. Make that movie. See, the cost of racism is you don't know what happened in this country. You glorify slaveholders as heroes because you don't know they're slaveholders. You're not taught that. You walk around in complete ignorance of that. You have political leadership in the 19th century that ignored slavery. Right? The people that said abolish slavery, we are taught, are fanatics. William Lloyd Garrison, all fanatical abolitionists, all fanatic. John Brown, oh, he's crazy. John Brown, oh, he's crazy. Oh, no, crazy. No. What did Garrison believe? Slavery was wrong, should be abolished. Why does that make you crazy? Why is that a sign of lunacy? Why is Tom Jefferson not crazy for owning slaves? And William Lloyd Garrison's crazy for wanting to abolish slavery. What you teach in your books. You know, look at the paragraph on William Lloyd Garrison in any textbook you got. See what they say about it. And John Brown. What did John Brown want to do? John Brown believed in direct action. He was a good American. Got a problem, solve it. How do you solve the problem of slavery? John Brown said, well, it's very simple. You kill all the slaveholders. That's the American way, right? That's why we have the largest military in the world. When we have a problem, kill it. Right? You don't like something, kill it. Right? That's why we got this massive military. Right? You got to drop bombs on it. John Brown was an American. He said, we have a problem. Slavery, kill it. They say, oh, no, he's crazy. Why is he crazy? Well, he started to do it. Went to Kansas and Nebraska, to stop the expansion of slavery by killing slaveholders. Guess who caught him? Robert E. Lee at Harper's Ferry in the Union Army. And they told John Brown they were going to hang him. John said, I understand. I lost. I didn't win. And his last words were, he said, do you regret what you did? He said, you know, the problem was we didn't kill enough people. He said, I made a mistake because I thought we could solve this problem by killing a few slaveholders. He said, we're going to have to purge this land with blood before we end slavery. Now, you would think that somebody listening to that would say, slavery is a problem, let us end it and solve this problem. Nobody did. What happens 2 years after John Brown is dead? Fort Sumter, the Civil War. There are more casualties, dead and wounded, in the Civil War than in all the American wars combined, all of them, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Spanish-American War, and the numbers in Iraq. More in the U.S. Civil War to abolish slavery than in all the wars this country's fought combined. No. But if you had said to white Americans, give me 1 million lives to free the slaves, they said, no, I'm not doing that. But to ignore slavery cost 1 million lives. Right? To not have compensated emancipation, if you had in the West Indies. Right? To ignore racism, right, cost almost 1 million white people their lives. Not black people. They wouldn't even let us in the army. You know, there are only 200,000 black people that had to fight their way into the army to fight. Right? They had to demand the right to fight. Then they wouldn't even pay them equal wages. So they said, don't pay us anything. The 54th and 55th turned back to pay. They said, we can't pay you what we pay white people because you're not good enough. And besides, you're black. They said, don't pay us anything. We'll fight for free. Right? For free. It cost 1 million white people their lives. And over 1 million white people their limbs and their arms. Over slavery. But if you had put that on the table, nobody would have bought it. But the failure to deal with slavery, that's the price white people paid. No, for looking the other way. For ignoring it, saying, well, it's not my problem. We'll deal with it next year sometime. Right? So you think maybe people would learn. Right? After slavery is over. All black people say, well, let's forget about the past. Don't dwell on slavery. Can we have the minimum to live as Americans? We work for over 250 years with no compensation. Can we have just 40 acres, small farm, and one mule to work it? No. No. Can't have it. Son American. You're free now. You're on your own. Well, what about back pay? No. No. You're not entitled to anything. You're free. You're on your own. And so black Americans tried to put their lives together as ex-slaves and made the most remarkable transitions in American democracy this country's seen. The first public schools in the South were put into place by Reconstruction governments dominated by ex-slaves. Free public education for everybody. You had no public schools in the South because to educate white Southerners would be the slaves might hear something and learn something, therefore nobody gets educated. Right? The price of keeping black people dumb is to keep white people just as dumb. And they're proud of it. At least they're not black. Right? That's why even today, when you think higher education, great schools, you don't think Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. Some of those places didn't get mandatory school attendance until the 1970s. You didn't have to go to school. It wasn't the law that said you had to go to school in Mississippi until the 1970s. Right? White or black. You know. Black people set up the public state universities in the South during Reconstruction. University of South Carolina. First president was a black man, Richard T. Greener. University of Mississippi. University of Georgia. For everybody, not just for themselves, for everybody. White people looked at those, threw the black people out, said, this is barbarism. We can't have this, like, put them out. And then they kept the schools. They didn't say the schools are bad. They said, you can't have them. They hadn't thought of it themselves. And then they threw black people out of political office. The Klan, armed struggle, you know, military force drove black people back into desegregation, disenfranchisement, you know, segregation. And then you had the turn of the century, you have Jim Crow. Right? Where they said, we're not going to deal with race anymore. It's too much of a hassle, but you're here today. Right? We're going to let Southerners handle Southern problems. And if they think it's necessary to oppress the black population to keep things in order, that's okay. Right? How do you pay for that? Well, you know how you pay for that? When white immigrants come over in the 1880s in large numbers, 14 million from 1880 to 1920, right, what they learn how to be is white. They're not white in Europe. They're Italians, they're Germans, they're Poles, they're Irish, they're Jews. When they come to America, all of a sudden there's something called white. And they say, look, in America, regardless of how low you fall, there are black people up underneath you. So you know where you're better off when there's no black people around. Right? Or if they're around, you're stepping on them. That way you know you're not at the bottom. And white immigrants, by and large, bought this. And they established organizations that were segregated. Trade union movement, American Federation of Labor, right? The Brotherhood of Railway Trainmen, conductors, firemen, maintenance away, whites only. Plumbers unions, whites only. Mechanics, whites only. Firemen, whites only. Policemen, white only. You know. To this day, there are only three black people in the electrical unions in the state of Massachusetts. One, two, three. A legacy of that. We're not even going to talk about police and fire departments. We know about those. They're in the papers all the time. White only. Right? What is this to cost to white people? You form an all-white union and go to negotiate a contract. I want $2 an hour. I got news for you. I'll pay the niggas $1. Uh-oh. Don't like it? Quit. I get niggas in here for $1. Okay, I'll settle for the $1.50. It just costs you some money. Racism costs you money. I want unemployment compensation. Niggas don't have that. Okay, I'll pull that off the table too. To this day, the working class in this country is the most poorly organized in the world. And it took us to the 1930s to get the minimum of social gains that every European working class had in the 1880s. National health insurance, we don't have. Workers' compensation, unemployment compensation, Social Security, that had come to the 1930s. Why? Because every time white people ask for it, they say, black people don't have it. You want them to have it? They say, oh, no. So they didn't have it. People hurt themselves. Right? White workers took jobs that were hazardous because they were white jobs. The best example is working in textile mills. You know, North Carolina, 1920s, textile mill, big looms, huge looms, whole room, big as this room, white job. Right? No child labor laws. Who works in those plants? Young white kids. What is their job? To crawl up under the loom and take the knots out. What happens when you do that? You pull a knot out, the machine moves, the kid is crushed. Thousands of needles in their bodies and they die. That's a white job. Black people aren't allowed in those plants. Where are the young black kids? Going to school. Can't get a job in the factory. Send them to school. Racism is costing white people. White Southerners are sending their kids to work. Black people are sending their kids to school because they can't get in a racist factory. Who's hurting who? Who's benefiting from that? And then they finally unionize. They make a movie, of course, Norma Ray, white person. We know that's not true. They didn't unionize those mills until they brought black women in there. The 1930s. It's black women that said, we're not taking this. They said, no, we always take out the trash. No, this says work these machines. Like, nobody knows trash. And by the way, my husband's in the yard. He's not making no money, so we're going to talk about that too. You know, white women organized the textile workers in North Carolina. Black women did. And the white women dragged along behind. Of course, they make the movie. They're not going to put no sense to that. Halle Berry's not going to play no union organizer. Right? So y'all think that Norma Ray organized all them people. No. Racism costs you because you don't know what's going on. Right? You're confused. Right? How does this affect policy in this country during the 20th century? Those same white politicians that got the 3/5 representation under Jim Crow, they got all of us discounted. If I'm Eastland or Bilbo, Strom Thurmond, and I want to run for office, what's the population of my county or my state or my congressional district? 60% black, 70% black, they can't vote. There's a literacy requirement, but that means illiterate white people can't vote. There's a poll tax, poor white people can't vote. What is my constituency? 5 to 10% of the people in my congressional district. Who's that? Me and my cousins. And you wonder how I got seniority in Congress. There's nobody can run against me. There's not an immediate member of my family. And so white Southern congressmen dominated the Congress of this country for the first 60 years of the 20th century. That's why you have no Social Security, no health insurance, no public education money, no high standards for anything. That's why. And that's why when they put in Social Security, they explicitly exempted black people. The two occupations that black people had when they brought in Social Security, domestic labor and farm labor, were exempt from Social Security to the 1970s. Right? You think we're the only people that work on farms? No, the majority of farm workers are white. You think we're the only domestic labor? The majority of domestic laborers are white. In order to hold black people down, you hold down large numbers of white people. They haven't figured it out yet. You know, you can shut down any program in this country by saying it's good for black people. What about welfare? Oh, black people, black people. Majority of people on welfare are white. White. No benefits for them. No, no, they just laying up somewhere having babies. White women don't get benefits because of that. Right? But to stop the program, you show a black face. That's why racism costs you. Show a black face, you stop the program.
My fault, Roz. Here we go.
Been happening across the African continent. You know, the news never stops. And there was a shocking,
not that
revelation that came out. So apparently, there's a German...
Okay.
You remember it?
Okay, yeah, here we go.
White okay. Men. And dying... Ryan Cooper has a really interesting piece over at theweek.com. You'll recall back, I think it was Tuesday this week, I was talking about how middle-aged, middle-class white men are committing suicide and dying from alcoholism and drug addiction at a rate that is causing the death rate for the entire cohort of white men from roughly 35 to 60 or 35 to 54, as I recall, was the age range, is causing their death rate to go up in ways that we haven't seen since the collapse in any demographic like that, since the collapse of the Soviet Union. For a couple of years there after the collapse of the Soviet Union, similarly, you saw men dying like this for this reason. And it was, you know, because of economic uncertainty. But Ryan, you know, and the thing that I had missed in my analysis of this, you know, I talked about racism. I talked about how, you know, my dad had that middle class, white middle class dream, you know, of when he came back from World War II, getting a job in a tool and die shop and getting a home in a suburb with the GI Bill and all these things that most African Americans were blocked from in the 50s. And my point was, we need to be sure if we're going to put this economy back together, if we're going to change our trade policies, if we're going to bring our factories home, if we're going to put our cities back to work, that we do so in a way that's colorblind, that or, you know, to the extent it can be, that is all inclusive. Because by and large, the boom, the middle class boom in the 50s, I mean, we were a legally segregated society at that time. That boom was largely confined to white men about the age who are committing suicide now. And they're committing suicide because that future that they thought they had, that they grew up with, you know, looking back on their parents, they don't have it. But Brian Cooper says poor white Americans are dying of despair and racism is to blame. And, you know, I thought this was fascinating. He says, well, basically, that, you know, poverty isn't, he says, American poverty is increasingly brutal. Male wages in the bottom fifth of the income ladder, for example, for instance, have fallen by over 30% since the late 60s, and inequality has exploded. These days, those in the top 1% capture virtually all economic growth. I mean, if you've ever listened to Bernie Sanders, you know that to be the case. But then it gets really interesting. He says, now, the reason that, so, okay, you've got that, and you've got all these white, you know, quote, middle-class men, middle-aged middle-class men who, you know, in a previous generation, right now at this point in their lives, would have been making, you know, in today's dollars, $30,000, $40,000 a year, in some cases much more than that, $50,000, $60,000 a year in some cases, and so even $70,000 in some of the more specialized factory jobs. And now they're laid off, they don't have a job, and the social safety net in America is not strong enough to catch them. Right? Unemployment has been limited to a year in most places. The Republicans 2 years ago refused to extend long-term federal unemployment. It still has, you know, it's still blocked. Welfare is only available for a maximum of 5 years. We are, what, 6 or 7 years into a Great Recession? And he points out that the reason why during the Clinton administration they cut back on welfare, during the Reagan administration they cut back on housing and education assistance, during just basically through this whole thing, is that and why universities have become more expensive, they've done away with free education, their disability insurance, unemployment insurance, all dialed back. No child allowance, no paid vacation, stuff like that. The reason all that stuff has gone away is because historically, the white people who were the majority of the voters voted against it because they believed, this is going back to Reagan's welfare queen thing, they believed that these welfare benefits were going to black people. And the white people were saying, you know, we don't want to be paying taxes to be supporting a bunch of black freeloaders. And now the white people are in the position of needing those resources, and they're not there, which is something African-Americans could have told you for a long, long time. Not to mention that the jobs aren't there, which, you know, has been the case for African-Americans for a long, long time. So I wanted to update my rant. I thought that was just a fascinating insight and a really worthwhile one. To watch more clips from our
Is it Dr. Mumbi?
No, it's the Banner, David Banner.
Okay.
And then we'll get started.
And the thing that I'm telling people for the most part is I don't want your religion. I don't want your help. I just want you to leave my people alone. You know, they always tell black people to get their stuff together, but every time we get it together, you burn it down. Or you find a way to put fraud on top of it. Because the truth is we are the child race of America. And us being ignorant financially, socially, and mentally, we spend like children. We act like children. So us acting the way that we act right now, America makes billions of dollars off of it. So for me, I'm asking everybody, just step back and allow black people to do their thing. Mm-hmm. And I am very serious when it comes to my people. Rock, I will tell you this. If you want to solve the problem of white supremacy, there's only two things you can do. Praying ain't one of them. Marching ain't one of them. Debating with your enemy is not one of them. There's only two things white supremacy respects. It's the loss of life and the loss of finance. When they passed that law in Mississippi, and in North Carolina, what did they do? They contacted PayPal, and PayPal said they're pulling their contract and their company out of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. That is what Black Fist is about. It's about you're either going to affect finances or you're going to affect somebody's lives. If those cops felt like if they killed a black man, woman, or child, and something was going to happen to their family or going to happen to them personally, they wouldn't do it.
You said earlier that you felt that integration was one of the worst things mm-hmm. that could have happened to black folks.
It is.
And you speak a language now that certainly at a minimum talks about a total reliance mm-hmm. on self.
Yep.
So does that equate to a form of separatism?
Well, if you had a child, Rock, that stayed in your house and wouldn't leave for 500 years, right? Would you respect that child? If you know that that child, in order for that child to live, it needed you, if it was hurt, you need their food, their electricity, their hospitals, everything about them, it doesn't really matter what that child says to you, does it? Because they have to do what? Come back to you. Right. See, the thing is, before we can be respected by anyone, everything that I'm telling you, the answer to everything that you ask me today is self. Mm-hmm. Religion, socially, business-wise, it doesn't matter. Until we get ourselves together, it really doesn't matter. It is all about self. And then when people, it's so funny, and this is one thing that I hate about America. Because I love black people, don't mean I hate anybody else. Mm-hmm. When I talk about white folks, historically, I can tell you, Rock, you name one place on this earth that an old white man has gone, that the indigenous people of that land hasn't all, if not totally been annihilated, haven't almost been totally annihilated. When is the last time you've seen a Native America in traditional garb? When is the last time you even seen a buffalo, the indigenous animal and indigenous people of this country? When have you seen them? So they talk about how violent we are. But black folks ain't done nothing but love folks. Native Americans haven't done anything but love folks. The indigenous people of most of these places in the world are people of love. And for me, you have little China, you have little Russia, you have all of these little subsections of America. Why can't we have little Africa? It's not that I don't want you, but I'm just trying to get myself together. But we spend trillions of dollars. If we got ourselves together, that's going to affect them financially. And what did I say that white supremacy hate? The loss of finance or the loss of life?
Okay, go ahead, Roz.
Greetings to everyone. Thank you for joining us this Tuesday evening, the 4th of December, 2018. This is Real Life, the radio show with myself, Roz, and my co-host, Jenna Kepler. First, before we get started, I just wanted to say, just to take care of very, very important business. If you listen to the shows on this network, if you get anything constructive out of those programs, please donate your financial energy to BTR or Black Talk Radio Network so that we can continue to stay on the air and provide the programming that, that you guys get something out of. It's just essentially that in order for us to be here, if you're getting something from it, then you should be paying it forward so that other people can get something from it. And, you can donate directly at blacktalkradionetwork.com. There's an icon there you can click to donate, I believe, through PayPal. Also, if not, there's a P.O. box address if you wish to mail in your payment rather than doing it through PayPal. Another way you can contribute to the network is to join BTR Community. BTR Community is a closed social media space in which Black people can actually have conversations that pertain to issues that affect our people locally, globally, nationwide. As long as it affects Black people, it's going to probably be discussed or is currently being discussed on the network. There is no advertising there. We don't get any advertising dollars whatsoever, so you're not going to see any ads. No one's going to sell your information to the highest bidder. You can also protect yourself as far as the privacy settings so that if you do go for a job or something of that nature, they won't pull up any discussions that you've had online, so you can protect yourself that way. So I would just say, and it's also just to finish, it's $24 a year for the subscription. You just pay that once a year and you're pretty much good to go. A lot of the radio show hosts are on there, myself included, and a lot of intelligent Black people just trying to solve problems that affect us all in some form or fashion or another. So that's another way that you can join if you aren't able to donate. So please just do so. That'll assist us in staying on the air and keeping the information flowing. And we just appreciate whatever you can donate. Don't think that any amount is too small. Everything that you submit will be greatly, greatly, greatly appreciated. So with that being said, we're going to get into tonight's show. So tonight's show is basically Urugu Part 2. And we're dealing with, Dr. Wilson has always said this, and there's a lot of other scholars and doctors who've said the same thing, that, white people are an inbred race. And ultimately, the same way they've bred pedigree dogs, you know, they don't mix species. Dog's natural inclination is to sleep with another female dog, regardless of what the dog looks like. But in order to specialize dog's behavior, mannerisms, temperament, and the jobs that they are able to perform in service of modern day white people, they created something known as pedigree. So they only allow dogs to mate within their species. And they try to breed whatever traits they need from that species to do the best job, because they're basically dogs or working dogs, pretty much, that have become pets. So that's basically what they've done with themselves. And there's mental insufficiencies that come with being inbred, whether it's the animal kingdom or the human kingdom. And what you were listening to is the mental illness that is white supremacy. And they explain quite eloquently how poor white people believe that they're getting benefits out of practicing racism that they're really not getting. Because the only people who are really supreme are powerful and rich. The poor white people are viewed no different than we are. And when you go into the early history of this country, you really get to see that in a way that's quite profound. Actually, there's something I wanted to touch base from. This is a book called The Birth of a White Nation, The Invention of White People and Its Relevance Today by Jacqueline Badalora. And she makes some points that are just quite telling about what this country was like before white people were invented. So she writes here, starting on page, this is in the very early section, this page 22 of like the foreword. Sociologist Susan Lay Starr, working within the field called sociology of science, utilizes social constructionist theory to examine the making of scientific certainty in medicine and science. I draw upon the sociology of science and the work of Susan Lay Starr in particular to objectify constructive and persuasive efforts involved in producing, in this case, a category of humanity within a legal text by rendering these efforts into objects or artifacts of knowledge production. They can be taken apart, carefully examined, and identified as one piece of a larger whole. The goal, according to Starr, is to try and understand such processes over time and to try and make sense of the language and meanings held by respondents and link them with institutional patterns and commitments. She calls on us to remember that the result, the scientific fact, could always be different. This book argues that the group of humanity called white people, quote unquote, is the product of a tremendous human effort, as you will see in the chapters that follow. On the one hand, the invention affords psychological and material value to whites, quote unquote, while dehumanizing and degrading on the other. The first point will be fleshed out in chapter 2 through 4, while the latter point will be explored in the final chapter of the book. Anti-miscegenation laws in the colony of Maryland and lawmakers' response to Bacon's Rebellion in colonial Virginia combined to help reveal the invention of the human category white, quote unquote. In chapter 1, white is revealed as one category among others competing to name the community of privilege as, quote unquote, British alone became increasingly insufficient. It is shown that the human category white was built upon the idea of the British as white, Christian, and of their essence free and deserving of rights and privileges from which those insufficiently British-like could be denied. Naming a group of humanity with a label that sticks is no small feat. It reflects a significant social achievement. The invention of white people is revealed as an extension of a compartmentalization of humanity beginning to be carved out by elite British and European colonists, decades before Bacon's Rebellion, the rebellion that is held out as the critical historical event that gave rise to white people, and before the idea of race had any footing. In chapter 2, Law as labeling as a labeling institution is explored, the series of laws that asserted and imposed the human category white and its ideological underpinning. In the decades following Bacon's rebellion, worked to discipline communities by transforming relationships among laborers and imposing a hierarchy that had not previously existed. They also reveal the ties between the invention of whites and a distinctly white patriarchal rule. British elites made connections with European laborers in part through the bodies of white women. Finally, the laws reveal the connection between the creation of a human category and the particular exploitative version of capitalism taking hold. This version of capitalism depended upon slavery. Immigration and naturalization law established by the first Congress of the United States reveals the success of the category white people. These laws work to institutionalize whiteness as a matter of foundational law within the new republic. The ways in which whiteness shapes human relationships, labor, and the U.S. citizenry is explored in Chapter 3. The impact of these laws upon those viewed as white in the U.S. as well as those of African, Chinese, and Japanese descent is considered. In Chapter 4, the limitations of law as a labeling institution are considered through U.S. expansionism, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, and the Declaration of Mexicans as white. The declaration of a group as white by federal law when there is existence at the community level is shown as insufficient to secure the social and political benefits of whiteness. I've referred to such a group as quote-unquote contingent whites, because their status as white depends exclusively upon specific laws and is not generally recognized in and through everyday social interactions. Mexicans were considered not white by state laws, with the exception of anti-miscegenation laws. The result is that Mexicans were rendered cheap labor, excluded from the full range of citizenship rights, and were seen as quote-unquote not real Americans. The experience of Mexicans in relation to whiteness is contrasted with that of Irish Catholics, who were initially seen as not white, but who succeeded in establishing their inclusion within the category. The efforts that these Irish utilized to win whiteness is revealing of the racialized political and social landscape in the United States and the barriers and opportunities it posed. The experience of the Irish helps to shatter the commonly held belief that white reflects, if not genetics, then the biological state of low melanin in the skin. Large numbers of Irish Catholics arrived upon American shores with low levels of melanin. It was only by and through their ties to the Democratic Party, espousing white supremacy, and their exclusion of persons of African descent from work sites that Irish became white. And I'm going to stop there. So this is going into when white people legally came into existence and actually came into existence, which was 1681. That's what she was discussing. And she was talking about the fact that they attempted to make Mexicans white, but the average citizen did not accept them as white. So as a result, to this day, they're viewed as non-white. But with Irish people, they aligned themselves at that time with the most racist white supremacist political party in the country, which was the Democratic Party, and they also sought to exclude American Africans as well. So by doing those two things, they were able to be ushered in and go from being called niggers and treated like niggers, as you see in Gangs of New York, if you ever watched that movie, to becoming white. And so essentially what we're going into is the whole concept of white supremacy and the way that poor whites have been indoctrinated, like Dr. Bracey was saying in the first video. He was talking about how ignorant white people are of the things that they've, like, even in the second video, when the white guy was talking about all the things that white people voted against under Reagan, under Clinton, and all these other people, having no concept of the fact that years down the road, the very benefits that you think you've been fooled into believing are being sapped up by black people and black people only, when the majority of people in this country are white, you not realizing you're literally destroying your own self until it's too late, because now the legislation has been in play for decades and there's no reneging on it now because the economy's falling apart. So they're not going back now to what it used to be. That's the thing about this country. When they make things worse, it stays worse and it just continues. They never go backwards. So this Go ahead, Jenna. Did you have something you wanted to say?
No, I was letting you go ahead on and finish. You can continue.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, ultimately, when you really, really start to get a foothold on the fact that the people who are really supreme are the people that are rich, that have money and the ability to change our daily reality politically, which ends up affecting us on the ground every day, is not the porn white people who have just been indoctrinated into, at least I'm not a nigger. That's the mentality they have. But yet the way that they're being used is as a buffer between black people and the rich white people. And they have been falsely indoctrinated into thinking, because when you go back to Bacon's Rebellion, the whole origin of Bacon's Rebellion were indentured servant whites and enslaved whites, as well as indentured servant American Africans and enslaved American Africans, who came together to fight against those same rich white men and said, we're not going to take being mistreated and abused like y'all have been doing. And it was one of the biggest rebellion. It was the biggest rebellion of its type in this country's history. And they sought to come up with an idea. How do we break up the blacks and these blacks and these white groups from coming together? This can never happen again. And that's how they came up with the category white. We're going to basically make all of these white people white now. And we're going to give them certain benefits, or at least give them the perception that they're getting these benefits. And as a result, they're going to prefer to be white than to be black. And that's how we got them there. And it's just been a self-perpetuating prophecy and fulfillment of that prophecy over generations. So it's really gives you more insight, because there's layers to this system. And sometimes we kind of perceive everything in a vacuum. As victims, and because we're getting victimized from all ends, whether they're rich white people or everyday poor white people, they all are victimizing us. So we look at it in that kind of totality, which is sensible for survival purposes. But ultimately, I think understanding that is where, again, like I said, everything that white people don't want us to do is exactly what we should be doing. They created white people so that we could live this crap that we live in right now. This is exactly why they created the whole idea of white people, so that we could live the horrific existence that we're living right now. So if they want us to do that, we should be working towards the opposite. And that goes to the same thing with dealing with other black people globally. They don't want us dealing with them. That should be the first thing that we're doing. What brought Malcolm X's attention to a fever pitch to get him out of here was when he started working with leaders in Asia and South America and the Caribbean and the African continent and the so-called Middle East, which is really Northeast Africa, and started getting them on the same page as far as taking European governments to court for human rights abuses against the groups that they have worldwide genocided.
Man.
And that's when they had to get him up out of here. And I'll say the name of the book again, The Judas Factor, The Plot to Kill Malcolm X, by a man named Carl Evans, K-A-R-L-E-V-A-N-Z-Z. That book will really give you everything you need to know, including declassified documents. He also gives insight into the killing of Shea. He gives insight into the over 360 attempts on Castro's life. He gives insight into the death of Patrice Lumumba. He just goes in on a few, but specifically he's focused on what happened to Minister Malcolm X and why it happened and what the chatter was in clandestine espionage circles surrounding the headway he was making. And once him and Dr. King got it together, he had it sewn up at that point, because you had both factions at that point. You had two factions in this country that were black, those who were with what Malcolm's philosophy was and those who were with what Dr. King's philosophy was. So if you put those two together, you had 100% right there. And you add that to all the other leaders globally that he had on board, the world we're living in today would be completely a different world. They had to get him up out of here. So what were you going to say, Brother Jen? I'm going to silence myself for a second.
You was right on point. Greetings, everyone. Sorry about the technical difficulties. We'll get those shows up as quick as possible. Today, this was a I like that first video for sure. I like how he, and I see that Scotty had a comment. What I felt that
I'm just seeing it now.
What I felt that he was saying is that for the cost of keeping us down as much as they possibly could, they was putting themselves back as well. Right now, you said it. We living in a, every day is not so horrible. Sometimes it does get a little chaotic, but it's a lot done changed. And but the remedy is the same. Brother Scotty done said it many times before. Not you're not going to be able to get everybody, but there has to be a good number of people who are willing to do what needs to be done. And the first way to fix that is to start interacting with each other. That's the remedy right there. That will kick everything off. I like how the white dude was making this plea while he was practicing racism on his radio show.
Okay.
You know, while he was still shooting his shots. But also admitting that you done this to yourself.
Yeah.
So they were both pretty much containing the same thing for me. But this is something that I've been saying for years. I mean, I see it in person.
Yeah, we've talked about that before. Go ahead.
I've seen it in person many times. Jobs or just in the street, you know. The white boy's crazy. And they'll try to jump on the police. We see it in the videos. But it's like you said. As long as it's not us. And that's the consensus that they have.
Right.
I'll take a couple blows from this white man while he's drunk. He just drunk. Put him in the drunk tank. But us, on the other hand, we know what happened to us. I think the biggest key about that is that we recognize it and assess it in the right manner. I think sometimes we live on a fantasy to where it's a lot of us that might want to do something extra sometimes, putting ourselves in a bad situation. Sometimes the idea of flight would be the best reaction. But under the pretense of not necessarily what someone else may think, but just out of all of the propaganda that they get via social media, the news, friends, just wherever the information is coming from, you might want to be that one that particular time. I'm going to do something about this now. And most times that's not the right time to do it because you had to think about it. But we don't think like that for the most part. Not everybody, but we are reactionary people.
Absolutely.
Once again, I think not the answer to the problem, but at least the spark to get it started would to have a space such as Scotty, BTR community, to be able to discuss these things. Almost like we've had the conversation here on the air a bunch of times about the voting locally. And right. I know it's a lot of people that say that don't matter. But what if all of us, not all of us, excuse me, but a good percentage of us around the country all get on the same page and voting for the same type of candidates? There's that power again. But we don't have that. And that's the one thing people always leave out when they talking about these other groups of people and why we can't just do it like that. Minus we're not even going to talk about all of the hardships. We're just going to talk about right now at this time. We don't have a big faction like that. we're all separatists amongst ourselves. While everybody else has a group that they can cling on to. Mm-hmm. So that's why I always say that bind power that people be talking about, I always say that's imaginary. You can't.
Anytime someone says that, I just see a giant drain with like all of the cash going down the drain. That's really what it is.
I mean,
once you spend
you
it, it's gone.
Yeah,
it's out
you
of your hands.
Have
you don't
no
spend
power
how money without home.
If ahead. You give it away, you can't have no power if you give it away.
Yep.
So, buying power, that has nothing to do with anything. But it's that section though. But I could be mistaken.
I think the point you made made a lot of sense. Matter of fact, oh, I see we got someone on the line here.
Yeah, but
Pete,
we
do you call her?
Finn, hold on, Kyle. I think that's Cujo.
Oh yeah, I think so too.
We're gonna let you go ahead and finish your thought, and then we're gonna go into this commercial break. I'm gonna get
okay,
right
so we'll
at
get you after
Cujo.
The commercial. I didn't even look at the time. So yeah, what I was saying was that I think what you said made perfect sense. There wasn't anything that I would say I disagree with. I just really think that the biggest burden to us in America specifically coming together is just ideological tribalism. We have yet to collectively define the problem and collectively coalesce around solving the problem. We tend to want to coalesce around other ideologies, and those are the barriers. We put, you know, these are self-imposed barriers. And, you know, when white people think because of that genetic annihilation, they, even if they don't like each other, they can come to a consensus and they'll put aside their stuff. And it doesn't mean that they don't have their arguments, because they definitely do. But that's the way that they've been so successful at dominating us, while we have been trained to find every difference possible between ourselves to get away from each other, whether it's religious, whether it's what the problem really is, whether it's who's light skin and who's dark skin, who's old and who's young, everything you could think of, we latch onto it. And what happens is we collectively stay pretty much almost idling in the same place with very little movement, unless somebody or some group of people tends to do something, which happens every so often, but it's just like we're pretty much stagnant. And that's the disadvantage we have. We don't have a code of behavior in terms of how we treat each other. So.
So we'll be right back after this quick commercial break. You're listening to Real Life Radio Show. Comes on, hopefully from now on, every Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Let's get this call in.
Yes, sir.
You're live on Real Life. What is your name? What's your question or comment?
Peace, Cujo. This is Cujo. And peace, Jenna.
Greetings.
Peace,
Ross. greetings to guests and listeners. Yeah, I just basically I got a lot from everything that you brought up in the early stages there. But two things that really stood out was about the Irish making that decision to side with racist white supremacists. And once doing so, it made me automatically think about some of the things that I heard Gus mention about being white means being racist, period. Like, and they made that decision, and that's when they were included into the group.
Right.
And then the second thing was, and this goes back to the tribalism we were talking about, which was the J. Ruta Damager song, Ain't the Devil Happy.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
it's a dope song, that whole album. And it's crazy, the album cover is the Twin Towers, by the way, before it got blew up.
Mm-hmm. And I knew him, too. I used to see him all the time. He's a good brother.
Yeah, was in East New York. But thing that's bugged is that in that song, he says, the key is know thyself, right? Mm-hmm. And the ill thing was, is that I saw an interview with him and the Fugees arguing.
I remember it. Yes.
You know what I'm talking about. Yes. Arguing about what is the path that our people should take and what is the most fruitful manner. And, you know, it's no judgment, VGQ, on Lauryn Hill, but Lauryn Hill was just, it just looked like a bunch of, pardon me for saying it, but it just looked like a bunch of niggas arguing. And J. Rue, you could tell kind of was falling back while Lauryn Hill was kind of the situation, bringing it to more of a head and being a little bit more aggressive.
Yeah.
Which I thought was ill. And her argument was the money, we need to get our money together. And J. Rue was like, it don't matter about the money, because if we get the money together and our mind and our spirit is not right, it don't make a difference. We're going to do the same thing they do. And I was like, wow. And then hearing the song and then hearing exactly what we're talking about on the air, which is we can get the money together. We can get these votes together and all these other things. But if our mind and spirit is not on point, it just doesn't even matter. It doesn't even matter. We're going to end up doing the same things that they're doing to the earth and to each other. You know, but that's pretty much all I had to say there.
Well, I would just say thank you for that addition, because it's that's what we see. I mean, Dave Chappelle had the joke about that, if we got reparations, and what everybody would do, what black people would do if they got reparations. And people were doing the most outlandish things, buying crazy material items that would end up being worthless, and just basically a bunch of show-offism, because that's the way we've been groomed. You know, we've been groomed to behave like an infantilized people. That's why in the last episode, we discussed the fact that, you know, regardless of what science says about our genetic-based intelligence and us being the highest genetic expression of what intelligence would look like, we have been retarded to the point where we are modern day versions of trying to be them. And that's that. When you look at that, right, the system of white supremacy is literally black people trying to be white people while the white people are trying to be black people.
Hey,
and the mentality is, I'm telling you that I'm better than you, but everything that I do, I'm copying you. You are the pinnacle of everything that we are. What they call American black people are the pinnacle of what as far as culture, as far as just historical relevance. I mean, everything. And they try to be us. There's the whole thing called blackfishing, with a whole bunch of white people that's trying to make themselves look black. And then you have black people killing themselves to try and be white. That's why I said this is a culture of insanity.
Ross.
You know, yes.
Real quick, let me cut in for a second. We got another call on the line. Brother Scotty.
Greetings.
Peace, Brother Scotty. How you doing?
I'm doing the best that I can under these conditions.
All right. I hope it gets better, because I know what you mean.
But go ahead, good brother. It was good to hear from you.
I would like to offer a different perspective, but I mean, there's a number of things, and always, you know, y'all guys host an engaging conversation. The first thing was, you know, when he was referencing, I had a comment in the chat. You know, I was listening to the first or the three clips that y'all played.
Yeah.
And the first two speakers did a great job in telling you how black people ain't got nothing. Okay. Historically, how they've been denied opportunity and access. And not that we're talking in handouts. We're talking reparations, which was earned. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, what's
and talk about legalized discrimination, also known as Jim Crow. That's when, by law, they can legally discriminate against you based on your skin color, and you can't take them to court. You can't do nothing. That's right. What it was. Okay, but then Mr. Banner comes on and say integration is the worst thing to happen to black folks. I've heard that too many times. I think it's a talking point among certain schools that has no basis in truth whatsoever. Because when you look at what quote unquote integration was, it was the passage of a law that outlawed discrimination based on race, national origin, religion, and sex. That means that you can no longer just pay black folks, you know, a dollar and then pay the white folks $1.50. If a black person can prove that you're discriminating against him in pay, he can take you to court and get back pay and get damages. So I just don't understand the logic in knowing, you know, not to mention the outright blatant terrorism, you know, the strange fruit hanging from the trees. And I mean, this was a common occurrence, and nobody would ever be charged. Okay.
Right.
Would ever be charged, prosecuted, let alone convicted and sent to prison. That's not the case anymore. So when people say we made no gains, and I've been guilty of saying that in the past, that's not true. The conditions that we live under is, in my opinion, is much better than the conditions that my grandfather lived under, my great grandfather, my great great grandfather lived on. I'm talking about the black ones, okay? So I think we're being a little bit disingenuous when we say integration is the worst thing. So what? Because I can take that as saying let's bring back Jim Crow because black folks had it so good during that period. You know, it does not line up with the evidence. It doesn't line up, you know, what was going on. Are you saying let's go back to them days? Absolutely.
Now, I want to offer something to you, too, because I've heard that discussed before. And I think it ties into like when we discuss the meaning of a term and us being on the same page, because I've heard that from older folks, but it was in a different context and it wasn't in a legal context. It was more presented as like the ones who, like my father-in-law, he told me that he thought that integration caused confusion for black people in a way that the back in the days it wasn't confusing. And he said to me that that a lot of us thought that things would improve once we lived amongst each other, and things really didn't. It's just that black people became more confused. And he told me that when he was younger, because my father-in-law died at 88, he said, even though we didn't have the best of facilities, which of course integration helped with that, he said one thing he remembered was that all of his teachers were black, his neighbors were black, and he lived in one of those areas where black people were taking care of themselves. So he said that that's what he felt we lost with integration, was the ability to work with each other and to have a cohesive communal environment, pretty much.
Yeah, but what? So we want to go back to the communal environment of sharecropping?
Oh, no. I'm just saying, like, I'm saying the way that some people are looking at integration, it's in a more pigeonhole kind of a way. It's not in that holistic, like you understand what I'm saying? Go ahead, I'm sorry. I
see what you're saying, but what I'm saying is these people have a false notion of history. They have a false notion of the history, man. Okay, America is still segregated as it ever was. Like Malcolm X said, it's never more segregated than on Sundays. Just because in a very small minority of us, and I say a very small minority of us, may be able to afford to live in these, you know, lavish apartment buildings where it's predominantly white, or some of us are able to move into these gated communities. That's not the majority.
Right.
That is not the majority. America is still very, very segregated in terms of separation physically of the races.
And, absolutely.
Race is a political construct. And I feel like also that I don't know how much we contribute to it by even think about it this way. We know that these wealthy white land stealing Anglo-Saxons came over here when y'all was talking about Bacon Rebellion and all of that, created whiteness as a way to solidify their power and give a few privileges to the poor people they now going to call whites that weren't white in Europe. Why do we still subscribe to that concept if we know what it was done for? Myself included. That's something I ask myself philosophically. You know, I used to give my
and it's a brilliant question. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I used to, you know, I got into, it wasn't an argument, but a debate with one of my older cousins who was like, you know, I don't subscribe to color codes no more. I don't call myself black. I don't call people white. You know, we just human beings. And I was like, you know, yeah, you can say that, but, you know, we know racism still exists and all this and that. But I understand better now what he's saying, that we're buying into concepts that we didn't create. And then some of us even know why the political construct of whiteness was created, but we still subscribe to it mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And so are we part of the problem?
I would say absolutely. I've said it. I said we all have been infected. And it really would take for us to get this information out to as many of our people as possible and tell them part of the solution is changing the language around how we discuss other so-called racial groups, other groups of people.
Yeah.
Like, I could see if you use white in a descriptive term, if something happened to you and somebody committed a crime and you have to describe them to a cop and you'll say, well, the person is lacking melanin. You're going to say they're white because that's what everyone's familiar with. But outside of that context, like, we should not be using those terms. I agree. It's just that I think not enough of us have this information at all. Like the brother in the first video said, you know, in order to keep black people stupid, you got to keep a whole lot of white people stupid.
Right.
There's a lot of white folks that don't know this stuff. And it's funny because Jenna was the first person I ever heard. He had said this to me years ago. He said, you know, I understand us, you know, trying to develop strategies to fight the system of white supremacy, but we give white people too much credit. A lot of stuff that we think they know, they really don't know. And over time, I started seeing what he said, because my experience in New York was very different to his experience down where he is. And from what he had encountered and some of the, you know, personal experiences, sometimes I would be on the phone with him and hear him go through these exchanges. And I was like, yo, what he's saying is starting to make sense. They really don't know. They're just born. Matter of fact, Jenna, can you give the descriptive you gave earlier? Because I think it was brilliant and to the point about the Christmas gift.
Oh, you're talking about.
Yeah. Yes, to describe how the system works today and why you have a lot of people who are not educated, but yet they're white. They're not educated about the system of white supremacy. They know nothing about 1681. They know nothing about Bacon's Rebellion, but they're fully immersed in practicing racism. Can you just break that down using that brilliant
the
analogy?
Well, it went that racism is a gift. These young white people open up their Christmas gift and it's racism. Everything they know from that point on is all racism. It's their favorite toy. They don't know nothing else about it. That's just what they got and they've been enjoying it ever since. So if you happen to get into a deep conversation with most of them, they have no idea about what you're talking about. So you
now
get
that, me to my other point. I don't see poor whites as being any different than the confused, what was called confused black people and what mm-hmm. happened, or tribalism. Tribalism mm-hmm. still exists in Africa, and it existed. I mean, are all Africans, do they view themselves? And I ain't talking about the conscious ones, okay? I'm not talking about pan-Africanists. I'm talking about your everyday African. Does he see himself as an African, or does he see himself as, let's say, a Nigerian or Ethiopian or Eritrean or whatever? You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
They still have disputes over there.
Yeah, they see themselves as their ethnic group. So if it's the Tigray, it'll be the Tigray. If it's the Amara, and this is Ethiopia, it'll be the Amara people. If you got, you know, the Wolof or the Yoruba or the Igbo, so they see themselves by their ethnic group. And because of the historical disputes between ethnic, to this day, you got tribes,
that's
traditional
what,
African tribes who are still fighting over
Scotty's
borders because
about.
Of the borders that the white people put in place, and they want the old borders back, but it's just not happening right now. So everything you're saying is accurate. Go ahead.
Yeah, but you're talking about the tribalism here, though. That's what you was talking about, right?
Yeah, I was saying it's ideological. Go ahead.
My point is, they ain't even laid aside tribalism in Africa. So, I mean, why do we expect people here to be any different? You know what I'm saying? And just today, I made a post today that I'm tired of the game life. I'm tired of political games. I'm tired of religious games. I'm tired of ethnic games. I'm tired of gender games. It's nothing but gang warfare out there. You know what I'm saying? And so I don't see white people. White people is the same way, man. All white people ain't on the same page. Or
but they on the same page with us, though. And that's the only...
I would say, I can't say that. I can't say that, Jenna. I can't say that. I really can't say that. I would say the majority of them may practice racism and view us the same way, but I ain't going to say all of them. But I'm talking about they fight each other all the time. I mean, there's a trial going on in Ohio right now where this dude is put on trial for running over that white woman at that
Charlotte.
White nationalist rally. They kill each other just like we kill each other.
Yes, you are correct. I didn't mean to say all, but what I was saying is as a whole, they click up, even if they into it, as a group. I mean, not all like you said.
Yeah,
but they come together on us, though. That's what I'm saying. But we have to come to an agreement to be able to disagree, because that's where the problem starts, is when you can't disagree.
Yeah. You know,
and they won't do that in front of us for the most part, the important ones.
I mean, I see them going at each other all the time on social media. I mean, it's like hate, man. They got hate. You a communist. You a LGBTQ fag, or you know what I'm saying? Really, they in decline, man. I just read about a week or so ago that life expectancy has been lowered, and we know that they being, drug overdosing, which I think is a result of those policies that guy was talking about, those social safety nets being taken away. That was discussed in that clip. So what do poor people do when they ain't got access to resources? They turn to illicit activity. They turn to the street market, you know? And that's why many of them is ODing on heroin and what have you, man. So
if you look at it,
it could be part of that suicide.
The new way that they're changing the laws now to help the white people that are using opioids is an attempt to actually give them, you know, like, hey, we're going to do for you what we didn't do for the black folks. You know, we're going to make it an illness now. It's not, he's not just some, you know, wayward drug addict that needs to be thrown in jail. You're going to be treated like a patient. Like, all of that is basically the attempt. Some states. Absolutely. It's not all states. Yeah.
They locking them up, dog. They locking them up.
Slavery's real.
Then, two, I ain't really seen none of them being helped, to be honest with you. The only thing I've heard about in certain cities like West Virginia or certain states where they get them police Narcan, you know, to bring them after they done OD'd. And I've heard white, some of the more powerful white people complaining about how much it's costing. So they really don't want to do that, though. But in order to manipulate the poor white classes, then that's what they got to do. They got to throw up some, I guess I call it, you know, some symbolism or some tokenism, and, oh, we're going to help y'all. They ain't really helping them.
Because I know in Jersey, they have, like, all kinds of programs throughout the state. They got commercials that, you know, like, for literally for facilities, and they're like, hey, you know, the state will pay for it. Just get your butt in the facility. So I know in Jersey, they're really trying to do stuff, because Christie was doing it before he left, and now that this guy Murphy's in office, he's just continuing and adding on to it. So I know in Jersey, they actually are trying to do stuff. I don't think they're that successful, because there's way too many of them throughout the state.
Because I heard some of them saying, you know, it's actually facilitating the abuse, because they know if they OD, you're going to come bring them back to life.
Exactly. And that, and you know how the addicts are. When somebody takes a hit of a drug that kills them or close to kills them, that's when people really want it. They're like, oh, that's going to get me super high. That's exactly the mentality.
I'm just saying, though, I think sometimes we too hard on ourselves.
And
we know ourselves. And we think that we so dumb and stupid, man. And I just don't think that's the case. Are some of us? Yes, of course. You know, but I don't think that these people are any different than any other people on the planet. Tribalism is all over the world, man. And, and like you said, man, that was a good example, the movie you gave. What was it, Kings of New York? Not Kings of New York.
Gangs of New York. Yeah.
Gangs of New York. Kings of New York. Was about different gangs. Yeah.
Yes. You got it, brother.
Yeah. But the gangs in New York, I mean, that right there, and they still engaged in that type of stuff, though, man. But just saying, man, we shouldn't be so hard on ourselves, man. We had the stack is just stacked against us, man. We have so much more to deal with. And I'll close with this. I had interviewed this guy. I can't remember his name. I can't remember the name of the book. He wrote a book, and he had this theory that slavery retarded the brain of black folks. And I was I think that was absurd or whatnot. But then I've been giving it some more thought, and he was like, yeah, you know, it passes on genetically, man. But
that's again, genetic.
I think that sometimes we too hard on ourselves.
I agree. And it's funny you said that, because a few weeks ago we did a program where I read like a scientific article that discusses the fact that when you deal with high stress on a regular basis, your brain shrinks. That's a scientific fact. That if you do not learn how to mitigate stress and you're constantly dealing with stress, that your brain will actually shrink. So the evidence is there. Our behavior, you know, the last program we did, I got into, like, you know, what we are capable of versus what we actually do every day and what we see ourselves doing and each other doing on a regular basis. And it ties into exactly what you said. I agree. You know, even Gus has talked about that. And he said what I said, the system is designed to retard us. And when you see what we hold as important, the fact that we can overlook what is happening to us in order to abuse each other on a regular basis rather than focus on the problem, it just ties into the fact that, yeah, there's something going on with a lot of us, myself included. You know, I do not separate myself because I'm in the same system. We are all infected. And, you know, the best of us, the most intelligent, most educated, whatever, we all have it, you know? So I agree. Jenna, you got the other. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
The last thing I'll leave you with, though, to answer Mr. Banner's question, or I don't know if it was a question or a statement about how to solve the problem of white supremacy. I think Mr. Fuller has already answered that question. Practice justice. That's what he said. We all have to practice justice, not just black folks. Humankind has to practice justice and not mistreat people. Because he, like he said, man, you call yourself Afrocentric or Afro-centered or what, mm-hmm. they don't mean nothing if you don't believe in practicing justice and not mistreating people. That's what I think when the majority of the people on the planet understand what justice is and start practicing justice, mm-hmm. we will mitigate a lot of these problems.
You just mic drop right there on that. And I would tell people, there was a great video I saw last week on Colombia and what they've been doing with the Venezuelan people, just taking them in. Actually, a lot of them have even allowed them to stay in their homes rent free because they're just suffering. And because I think 20 something years ago when Colombia was having the FARC wars, the Venezuelans helped them. So basically they went back and now they're paying it forward. And a lot of folks don't know that Venezuela and Colombia were one country back in the days that split into the modern day Venezuela and Colombia. I forget the full name of the old country, but you can look it up. And ultimately they are helping them in ways that it really is incredible. Like just the empathy and the human decency and how they relate to each other. You've got a couple of, you know, criminal Venezuelans that have done some robberies and stupid stuff like that. But I mean, like the overwhelming majority of them are just decent people just trying to get something to eat and have a decent place to live. And that little documentary was just mind blowing as far as just the way that they dealt with each other. And we can take that as an example for how we should treat each other during a Katrina or any sort of major event that displaces huge numbers of our people. These are the things we should do to take care of ourselves so that we don't have to rely on other people, you know, do our best to help. I remember growing up and my mother and my grandmother used to always say, if somebody comes to your house, you always make sure you have something to eat and something to drink you could offer them.
Now let's stop right there. We're going to go ahead on and get into this break and,
okay.
And get a number when we come back.
All right. I forgot where I left off. I was thinking about that clip with Brother Larry and the last one with Dr. Mundy dealing with the voluntary colonization. I thought that was just important for us to touch on before we close out.
Which one you wanted to get on to first?
I would say probably, say it again?
Brother Larry?
Yeah. I will preface it by saying he has a couple of choice words in there. He's a, I think he thinks in a way that I think if we were exposed to that kind of thinking, we could probably get past some of our issues. This is a brother who spent 25 years in prison. So a lot of his education came from the experiences of going through that. But he's a pretty wise dude. So yeah, Jenna, just put that on because it's pretty short. But I think he just said some things that are kind of thought-provoking.
We'll be right back. because at that ultimate moment of death, Jesus.
My apologies.
Okay.
I had to sit wrong.
Some shocking truth, right? Some motherfuckers is the food so that others can survive. I'm gonna explain that in a different way. Some people are roadkill so that while roadkill is being devoured, other people can escape and keep the species going. Let me explain that another way. Some of you motherfuckers are prey animals. The predators have to eat. They gotta eat somebody. Better to eat a prey animal than to eat somebody that's making an actual active contribution to keep the species going. Let me put it another way. It's called natural selection. You see it in the animals. Not every mouse is gonna survive. There's cats. There's people. People eat them too. You understand? Not every chicken will live to produce other chickens. There's eggs. An egg never grows up to be a chicken. An egg turns into an omelet or an ingredient in a cake. It has the potential, but not every potential is realized. Stay with me now. Here you have some individuals that never get it. They go their whole life oblivious to everything around them except the thing that they're dealing with. And when you tell them, look what happened. They say, oh, what was that? What? I can't believe you don't see that. Not my business. And they keep going. They make movies about this. They call them the Matrix. You understand? People who are oblivious to everything but the shit that they're dealing with. But there's a real world going on around them that they have no idea about. That's the same theme, family. It's real because your neighbor, your next door neighbor, you have no idea what your next door neighbor is going through unless you talk to your next door neighbor and they tell you. They could be going through some traumatic shit. But because you don't talk to them, you're oblivious to it. It doesn't exist for you. Now, just like you understand that, I need you to understand that there's some shit going on in this country that your ass is oblivious to because you ain't looking at it. So you don't see it happening all around you. There's a Hispanic agenda unfolding where you got Hispanic speak or Spanish speaking people trying to field national candidates for office, trying to take the presidency. You understand? That's an agenda that's unfolding. That means there are people behind the scenes that are having conversations and engaging in strategies that don't concern you, that may affect you. You understand? Because if they enact their strategies to advance their agenda, they're advancing their agenda. They're not advancing your agenda. You understand? So now, if you're not engaged in activity designed to advance your agenda, to produce an effect that's favorable to you and your community, then you're a hindrance. You're a hindrance because you won't get out of the way. You won't encourage others when you see them trying to move in that direction. But at the same time, you will engage in contrary information that is clearly designed to produce a wedge that prevents the consolidation of the community from happening. See, at some point you have to realize that there are others who have vested interests and your ass staying the way that you are. It's profitable to a lot of people that the black community is in the position and in the shape that it's in. It is profitable to a lot of people that the black community is in disunity. It is profitable to a lot of people that the black community does not say we doing this shit for ourselves and we not dealing with foreigners.
So let me ask you, why is it profitable for the black community to be in disunity?
It's profitable to Dominican supermarkets. It's profitable to Jewish landlords. It's profitable to the Pakistani and Arab landlords that own these buildings, that's coming in here buying these buildings, that's opening corner stores. It's profitable to everybody that's doing business in the black community that the black community is not doing business in the black community. They come into the black community to make a profit. How can it not be profitable?
Man. Brother Larry.
And lastly, Dr. Wimby. But go ahead. But Larry, go ahead. Speak on him.
Brother Larry because that was Sinetta TV. It was a little clip. You can find it in the Real Life thread. But Brother Larry, I like to look at things from that perspective. Because mm-hmm. you waste energy sometimes. Because it'd be so simple. At least for this particular point in my life where I'm trying to move forward, come up with ideas, execute the plan.
Yes.
Now, what made you want to play that video tonight?
Well, the reason I wanted to play it is because I think he makes it plain. You know, he, like I said, 25 years in prison, so you're going to get those, you know, extra adjectives. But I think that the adjectives shouldn't block you from hearing the message. It's the message. And I think the way he looks at things is very simple, straight to the point, and logical. You know, like I remember one time he was talking about the so-called new age aboriginals. And he had said in a video, he said, well, I have Native Americans in my family. But he said, that doesn't mean I'm Native American. He said, a lot of people don't take into account culture. You know, he said the vast majority of these people shouting aboriginal grew up like black people. They grew up in the ghetto. They grew up playing basketball. They grew up saying nigga. They grew up doing all the things that, you know, if they're, you know, lower income black people, then they grew up doing all the things that lower income black people do wherever they are located. But yet they get this ideology and they jump on it and they say, well, because, you know, my great, great grandmother was this, that means that I'm that. And he said, really, what people are forgetting to connect is culture and lifestyle to the genetics. You know, and then he had said, you know, if an African person moves to France, does that make them a Frenchman all of a sudden? Of course not. They're an African who relocated to France. And he said, well, it's the same thing. Just because I have a grandparent or great grandparent that was Native American does not make me Native American. I'm a black man. I grew up as a black man. I look like a black man. And it was just common sense, logical stuff, you know, and the way that he approached this is it's true. People are making so much money off of the things that we do that are self-destructive or causes dissension amongst us. And he broke it down simple as heck as far as just going into the neighborhood and you got, you know, the East Indian or Arab guy that runs the gas station and, you know, another Pakistani runs the corner store and, you know, a Puerto Rican has a bodega around the corner. And it's just like we don't patronize ourselves. We allow everyone in and those people take their money to their neighborhood.
Hey, well, Ross.
Yes.
Brother Scotty has a question. Maybe he'll come in and clarify. But he says black unity, what it looks like. Did you say something, Ross?
Oh, no, I was saying I don't think that we could ever really be unified. That's the thing. I don't think that. I'm talking about like when I think from the perspective he's saying is just.
No, I'll give you the perspective, Ross.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
This is what I said. I said, can someone define what black unity looks like? Mm-hmm. All of us having the same religion, the same political philosophy.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking at it.
I've just been thinking lately about how we use these terms that are not clearly defined. Mm-hmm. Like today, you know, yesterday I was listening to Time for Awakening, another program on Black Talk Radio Network. They also have their own network that, you know, we built for them, Black Talk Media built for them. Check them out at timeforawakening.com. But one of the quotes, we always talk about an African mind. And I'm like, well, I'm saying to myself, you know, I ain't called in, but I'm saying to myself, because I was listening to the podcast and I probably wouldn't have called in anyway. He says it all the time. I'm like, what is an African mind? What Africans you talking about? Are you saying all Africans think alike? Subscribe to the same religious system, cultural systems? I know that's not true. So what I'm saying, and then like a sister said today, on social media, and we got into, you know, a constructive conversation. We wasn't arguing with each other. We just, you sharing our perspectives with each other. And she was like, if you don't have an African-centered worldview, then everything else will only confuse you, I guess, you know, borrowing off of Neely Fuller's quote about white supremacy. And so I asked the sister, I said, well, which Africans are you talking about? Again, I said, you know, are you, and, you know, I read a lot about Africa, especially during the period of slavery and what have you. And, you know, I was just reading today about, what is it? The Dogon, how do you say it, Ross? Dogon. The Dogon culture believes in female circumcision. That's when they chop off the little girl clitoris. You say that I should have that kind of mindset. You know what I'm saying? I was talking about the Chukosi system, religious system, where they give these little girls to the fetish priests as payment for the sins of the family, and these little girls are turned into sex slaves.
Yeah, this, I saw the documentary. That was crazy.
In 1979, but they still practice it. So I'm like, you know, sister, I'm not trying to be anti-African, but I'm saying that's a vague statement. I don't know what you're talking about.
Scotty. Yes. Can I interject real quick?
Of course.
Sure.
Well, I think, you know, and it's funny you said this. I was listening to Dr. Amos Wilson earlier today, and one of the things he was just mentioning and having children, I've just a lot of his look into a lot of his books. They definitely deal with the mind and development of African-centered children. But one of the things he was mentioning in his public speaking was just the fact that having an African-centered mind basically means to him, in his mind, and where I agreed, and I'm agreeing with you too, but I think that we need more clarity on it, is the things that you do, whether you are a comic book drawer, whether you're a mechanic, whether you're some type of high-level computer science engineer, it has to be geared in liberating and freeing your people from quote unquote racism, white supremacy. It has to deal with some form of justice towards contributing towards the group as a whole. Anything else he was saying would just lead us down the same path that we are right now. And he also has a book about black on black violence, dealing with the fact that black on black violence is basically, like you were speaking about gangster, like those are just gangs, but those are gangs that, although they resemble us, they actually are more detrimental and destructive to us than even some clan members, some clan groups. Like they're just as poisonous and toxic. So it was real interesting hearing him say that, and also then coming to the book. But I think that's where we need more clarity on that. And I think calling it out is important, because I hear a lot of people pro-black, Afrocentric, all these other terminologies, but to me, if you're not really dealing with trying to solve the problem in any shape or form, and any whatever you do, then I mean, how useful is it, and what really are you about?
Well, what the fuck said to me, Cujo, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, what she said to me was Ma'at in Kemi, and so I was saying that. Okay, I don't care what you practice. If you ain't practicing justice, then, you know, like Mr. Fuller said, you practicing injustice. So she tells me that's what, you know, and you just mentioned justice. And I said, well, My mama and my stepdad raised me to practice justice. They said, treat people the same way that you would want to be treated. Don't mistreat people. You want to be a decent human being. You know, don't lie, don't steal, don't do stuff to harm other people. That's practicing justice. I said, I learned that from them. And it wasn't coming from no African-centered perspective. I was like, justice should be universal. I think everybody has the ability to practice justice, but everybody don't want to practice justice.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And the reason being is for what we spoke. This is going back again to Dr. Frances Cress Westling's book. And one of the last chapters she deals with in her book, in the textbook, is that the plight of Black women in this century, in this time, and the fact that throughout the times, in the past, in Africa, a lot of Black women that were warriors, female warriors, these are some of the first female warriors on the planet, were fighting colonialism. And it wasn't until really things started to come over here to North America, so-called North America, where Black women started to step back and not only pull the men back and say, no, don't fight. I need you to survive so you live another day so that we can do better. But they did this also because they saw other men get strung up, killed, hanged, you name it. And that caused some type of confusion where Black women said, you know what, it's better for me to sometimes go this way just so that later on my children can be safe, my husband can be safe, and such forth. But in that process, it caused a little bit of an imbalance, because as you see now, Black women are doing more in our society, but at the same time, the trinkets, the things that they receive, we need those trinkets to like refunnel back into the community and make the community stronger as a whole, the so-called community. Like, we're still having trouble building that. But now, that kind of, go ahead.
I'm sorry. The last thing though on Black unity, again, and I think Jenna mentioned this earlier, and I've said it in the past, is that a pipe dream? You know, is it even possible? I say work with those you can work with, okay? And don't worry about the rest, because it'll be a source of stress. And mm-hmm. I was about to give the example in the chat, but I said on air, when I first started Black Talk Radio Network, I thought Black folks, a majority of Black folks on Blog Talk Radio, because that's where I started, when they found out that I had been kicked off, you know, because Black Talk Radio started over there first, and I had been suspended simply because of the name, anti-Blackness and racism. Oh, wow, Black Talk Radio, that's racist and all. And I got suspended, and I was like, okay, I'll build a damn platform. And all these Black people that's going to come over here, and they're going to support us, and we're going to leave Blog Talk Radio, and we're going to have our own thing. It didn't happen. It still ain't happened. Even though these people know about Black Talk Radio and they talk about supporting Black businesses and working together, they did not follow me over, okay, once we built this platform. And I used to stress out about it. And then I was like, you know what? Why should I be stressed out about somebody who talk the talk but don't walk the walk? Let me work with those and teach this skill to those that want to learn and be over here. And you see how few of us are here. I'll close. That's why I say I'm not stressing over Black unity no more.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I've always said, and I think David said this on Tando, it's really about us raising the babies. We are tainted. Like, we are just infected. And a lot of us are not going to change. You know, the way my parents raised me is not the way a lot of people around me were raised. And that was to support Black business. That was basically race first. If you can buy whatever you need from a Black person first, patronize that business. If you can't find it, any Black business that sells the product or provides the service you need, then you'll have to find a different route. And, you know, if you can support somebody non-white that's doing a quality job, fine. If the person happens to be white and they do a quality job, then that's fine too. But the whole idea was that to put, you know, your folks first. You know, and I think it's a cultural thing. It's the way you raise your child. It's like, you know, I always talk about the Jew because I see it. New York, they call it Jew York. I mean, it happens all the time in their neighborhoods. They have their own police system in New York City. They have like little vans and little Jews that run around and like deal with crime. They have their own tailors, their own delis, and they only support their own stuff. They have their own universities, Yeshiva University, that no one else can get into if they're not white and Jewish. And I mean, to me, that is the greatest example of just a situation where there's a code, and that code says our people first. We only patronize our people's businesses. And when you look at how many times the dollar turns over in the Jewish community, it's well over 100 times, and in some cases, hundreds of times before it leaves the community. So they remain an economic powerhouse, which they convert into political power, no matter how corrupt that political power might turn out to be sometimes. And to me, it's a cultural thing. And even if we as a generation don't have it, those of us that have that mindset, who come from that background or somehow developed that insight for themselves and said, hey, this is the way I want to practice my codified, you know, united independent way of functioning. I'm going to raise my children this way. And then that way it'll pass along, and hopefully over time it'll spread. That's what I did with my son. That's what I talked to my son about all the time. Like, this, everything that I've done was to help facilitate you putting your people first, practicing justice first, but putting your people first. And in so doing, pass that on to our grandchildren and so on and so forth, so that we can create a better future. Today is today. My generation did their job as best they could, and it sucked. So we got to try and raise the children to do a better job than we did. I could be incorrect. I will say that, but
it's creating that culture, creating a new culture.
Yeah.
We have a caller. I'm not sure.
I see somebody from Georgia calling in.
Peace,
you calling from Georgia? Just give your name and you can ask whatever question or make a comment.
Hello, can you hear me?
Greetings.
Yes, greetings.
Hi. This is Kiev. I don't know where y'all were. I couldn't find you. I'm glad I found you. I was like, oh, they went away.
Glad you found us too. I'm sorry.
Way to go. But I just want to say, I know we talk about supporting black businesses, and I'm all for that. But you have to remember, it's we say, like, oh, yeah, just go to a black business. You don't know, even in, I live in Macon, this, I think it's majority black city. I still don't know where the black people are. I mean, it's like you would think it would be easy here. I don't know. I mean, I kind of know where they are, but I don't really know the businesses and this. Mm-hmm. They don't advertise well. And things like that. And I'm not necessarily putting the onus on them, but we have to remember there were a lot of barriers that they have to go to, and you have to be intentional on purpose. Like, I just got my kitchen redone, mm-hmm. and my realtor, she's black. So because I didn't know, I said, well, let me go to the realtor because her husband does construction. I said, I want a black contractor. So, you know, she found a black contractor. He's really nice, older man, real nice. So, you know, all the things I needed, except for, I think, the countertop, because I don't know black people who have sites to dig up granite and whatnot. You know, everybody else was black. And even in that, yeah, you have a black electrician, but do they have their own copper and this and that? Yeah, I had a black cabinet maker, and they're beautiful cabinets, but where did he get the maple from? Was he able to get the maple from there? You know, we might do one or two things, and I think we have to encourage people maybe to open, to let us know they're in business, first of all, and to kind of go through the supply chain, because sometimes we think when we open a business, I think it's kind of, from a business sense, it's kind of lateral, the service, the food, funeral, things like that. Let's say even a funeral. Yeah, most you're going to go to a black funeral home, but do they make the caskets? Do they own the land where the body goes? You know, things like that. So sometimes,
can I interject here? You said it was Kia, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, I think you're making perfect sense. There's two things I wanted to touch on that you said. The first thing is being deliberate. It takes work to shop with your own. I know that Jews will leave their job, and there'll be delis all over the place, and they might be hungry, but they're not going to none of them delis that's right in front of them. They're going to wait till they get to Crown Heights, Brooklyn, get to their neighborhood,
go to
the Jewish deli.
Right to Kingston Avenue. I'm from there. They're all there.
So it's a deliberateness. They're deliberate in what they do. So that's what we have. That's where the culture comes in, from creating that culture. The other thing is, you said exactly what Dr. Clark said in the early 90s. We have to get back to just basic. We should be able to make our own socks. We should be able to make our own underwear. We should be able to make our own toothbrushes. Just the simple stuff first. And then you start to expand. He was talking about nation building. He said, we have all these lofty ideals about a nation because, you know, some of our people are eloquent speakers and orators, so they can make stuff sound really lofty and wonderful. But he said, we got to get down to basics, just making our own shoelaces. Just get one black person who can manufacture something.
Hey,
you know, he talked about the fact that those institutions and industries were systematically destroyed during the colonization process. So we have to now go back and rebuild those institutions if we're trying to become truly independent. So everything you said makes perfect sense, but it starts with changing the mind first. Enough of us aren't in a cohesive understanding of the fact that we even have a problem. And you can't solve something if you don't even think you have one. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. And I was going to say also, I'm sorry, sir. Did you want to say something?
Nah, you go ahead, sister, because we finna get ready to close it out. And I think Brother Scotty wanted to say something before we leave. But go ahead.
I was going to say also, some of the things that were done because of slavery, you know, because of slavery, people don't want to do them anymore. Like, no one wants to be a farmer and pick oranges and apples and stuff. Mm-hmm. But we need our own oranges and apple trees, you know. They turn it into a negative thing when it's actually, if you do it for yourself, it's actually a wonderful thing. And sometimes we have to, you know, train people that, like, coming from an urban environment, like I said, I'm from New York. You know, I never thought about that, but I moved down here and my family, you know, they live in South Carolina. You go and even they don't do stuff like that no more. They say, well, we used to do that when we were kids. We tired of it and this, that, and the other. And slowly but surely, because they live near Hilton Head, the white people, mm-hmm. I mean, when I was little, they just took over Hilton Head. And they weren't really where my family is. Now they're everywhere. I told my father, said, they're like roaches. It's like, no offense to them, but, you know, can we have one? You know, that's like... Like, I remember going down there thinking, you know, not, like, consciously, but, like, this is our space. I would never, we would go down there vacation. No white people. Black people. You know, doing everyday things, work at the store, blah, blah, blah. Now they coming in because they done found the water and,
Hey, well, thank you, sister. Hopefully we'll be able to hear from you again. We're getting ready to close this night out.
Thank you. Did Brother Scotty have something he wanted to chime in with before we close out, you said?
I agree with the things that Kia said, but, you know, in specifically talking about Black Talk Radio, I'm talking about people that know about us.
Right.
That still choose to pay way more money, you know, to have an automated system. And I understand automation and all of that, but I shouldn't say it's not hard. Everybody don't have technical inclinations or what have you, but it's easy to me. You know what I'm saying? And mm-hmm. I want to learn it, but if I want to truly be independent or, you know, practice what I'm preaching on my radio show, then I learn how to do it. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know, it's how much do you really want to commit to buying black or what have you.
Mm-hmm. But then, determination, yeah.
On the flip side of this, though, look at this wicked, evil capitalist system. This ain't of our creation. So I was saying, you know, it's kind of hard for us to thrive in this wicked capitalistic system because of racism, but... I mean, we can, but then we have to take on their characteristics. And then we still paying business taxes and all that, and we funding our oppression. So I'm just saying, we in a rock in a hard place, y'all. I don't have all the answers.
Yeah, I agree with you 1,000%. Because, hey, like you said, we all contribute to the system. Even if you have your own business, you got to pay taxes on it. I mean, like, so that is always going to be an issue. Right. You know, the main thing. Go ahead, Jenna.
We gotta get on up out of here. But I want to leave with what I stated earlier. Just what Scotty did, being able to have these discussions. That's the very start. That's the very start right there.
I agree.
If everybody starts,
I mean, I appreciate Scotty for that, because this is a think tank for us to do just what we're doing. Come up with ideas and try to help each other solve problems.
Baraz, you close us out and hit us with the prayer.
Yes, sir. Thanks to everyone for being with us this evening. Thanks to Sister Kia for chiming in. Cujo, Brother Scotty, all the other callers and listeners, thank you very much for spending your Tuesday evening into the night with us, December 4th, 2018. We appreciate you. We're going to say the prayer and close out. Creator, we ask that you help us to remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us to remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times in all places. Each and every time that we are in contact with another Black person, like Gus always says, it has been time. Let's replace white supremacy with justice ASAP. Let's end the prison industrial complex and stop human trafficking as well. I am in the love of the all, and all love is in me. I am a part of the all, and the all is a part of me. I am one with the all, and the all is one with me. I can succeed as a part of the all and fail as an individual. I can be all that I wish in the all, as long as my wish is to stay in the all. I am never alone. The all is, I am. The all can, I can. The all does, I do. Once again, thank you very much for spending your Tuesday evening with us. Have a wonderful rest of your night. Stay safe. Stay out of the hand of slave catchers. Sobriety will be best. And we'll see you again next week, Tuesday. Creator willing. One love.
One love. Before everybody go, we appreciate y'all. Just adding your life experience and the wisdom that you wanted to pass on. We appreciate that too. We'll see y'all next week.
Greatly appreciated.
Peace.
Peace.